Welcome to the continued podcast adventures of three opinionated guys with mics and too much free time. Strong enough to stop a speeding movie rumor, more powerful than a bad comic book event. Able to waste hours of time asking stupid questions to people who have better things to do. It's Dave, Ben, and John. It's Superhero Speak.
Hey everyone, you're listening to Superhero Speak, and I'm your host Dave. And this week I have two guests with me in the Speak Tower. We have a returning guest who has been on our show three times now, and a newcomer, and they're here to talk about their book, The Horror Show. So everyone, please welcome James Maddox and Todd Bestell. But I said that wrong, didn't I, go? Bestell.
Yes.
Okay.
Hey.
How are you guys doing?
Hi.
Doing fantastic. I'm trying to find out how much Comixology sold to Amazon for. And I can't find a number. Sorry, that just came across my newsfeed. I've been obsessing over it for the last 20 minutes.
Yes, well, it will change, I think, the face of digital comics for a while.
Yeah, yeah. Hopefully for the better, you know?
So yeah, we're here to talk about The Horror Show. And so I read the preview issue, and I need to ask James, when are you going to finally write your bunny stories? I had to say, though, it was, you know, like a lot of comic book readers, like, I'll go through a book quickly and look at the art and then go back and read the story. So when I looked at the art, I'm like, oh, it's another zombie book, you know. And then when I read the book, it's like, ooh, left hook. Ooh, another left hook. It's like, okay, so this is a James book. Okay, I get it now.
yeah, we, I had approached, well, I don't know how this came about, really. We were at either Louisville or Derby City Comic Con, and I had this idea kind of like kicking around in my head for years. And we were sitting at a pub with a bunch of other artists, and I was talking to Todd, and I told him the story of The Horror Show. And he looked at me, he says, if you think I'm not going to pick that up and start it, you're out of your mind. Which was awesome. But the whole point of it was I love horror books. I love all the things that are cheesy about them as well as all the things that are scary about them. And with The Horror Show, I found the opportunity to just make a book that was kind of a disgusting, demented love letter to the horror, you know, industry. And so far people seem to dig it, and thank God I got Todd because he was able to pull off this fantastic style that was filled with shadows and darkness. And, you know, it's not super gory, but it's got enough in it that it makes the horror fans kind of happy.
Yeah, I mean, I noticed that right away. Like you just said, I think a lot of times it's hard to do stuff at night, you know, in books and get across the images that you want to. And I feel, Todd, that you did a really great job on that. The shadowing's really well done. The images just work with the story. So was that something that you worked on, or you were inspired by James' story, or how'd that come about?
Well, thank you, first of all. The story is inspiring. It's just a brilliant story. But as far as the visual inspiration, I took that from the old Universal black and white horror films. I love the old Boris Karloff, Frankenstein, the Bela Lugosi Dracula. As far as the creature, I was inspired by Nosferatu.
Okay.
Just the creepiness of it.
Yeah, he nailed it. I wanted like really long, just kind of disgusting. Fingers were kind of a big sticking point for me, but I think we were pretty much in agreement that we wanted to come up with some kind of, like, not a totally new monster, but something that, you know, wasn't played out to death.
Right, right. No, and that's, I mean, I guess that's one question I have, too, is, like I said, when I first paged through it, I'm like, oh, another zombie book, but it's not. But is that a fear you had going into it, that people would just look at it as another zombie book?
Well, no, because I did that intentionally. You'd be surprised, but one of the more interesting ways to pitch the book to someone that's, you know, coming by your table at a convention is there aren't any zombies in this book. I know it looks like there are, but mm-hmm. trust me, you know, there aren't. Zombies are hot. They're always going to be hot, I think. You know, personally, I'll pick up a zombie story even if I roll my eyes at it first, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think that, again, I used something that was very familiar to kind of slide a new concept, or at least a better twist on horror than what you would normally find in a zombie book, you know? I think for the most part, from what I've heard other people say about it, they enjoy that it's not what it appears to be.
Right, right. And I think everything I've read from you so far, I have that going. I should know that automatically going in now, that there are going to be twists. Nothing is going to, you know, be straightforward. You know, it's, and that's what makes it enjoyable. You know, the straightforward yeah. stories are boring.
Yeah, yeah. Completely boring. And they're boring to write, too. You know, I think more than anything, it's just a playing with preconceptions. Right. I love messing with the reader, but for the reader's benefit. I don't know if that makes sense.
No. I totally understand it from having read this stuff. So Todd, James has been on the show before. We've heard his life story quite a few times. how did you get your start?
Well, you know, I used to watch the cartoons growing up. I used to watch the Spider-Man as Amazing Friends. Mm-hmm. I used to watch Batman, all of them. And it wasn't until the 1989 Batman movie that I kind of rediscovered comics, and specifically Todd McFarlane's art. He made me want to be an artist and obsessed over his work. I mimicked his work. And then went to art school and was told, don't draw like other people. And thought I'd go into comics. I took a comic book course taught by Daryl Banks from Green Lantern. Mm-hmm. And realized, man, this is a lot of work. That's too much work. Not enough pay, too much work. So I abandoned that dream and worked on pursuing art galleries, doing fine art. And then just a few years ago, connected with a friend of mine who wanted to write comics, and we hashed out an idea and decided, well, why don't we make this into a webcomic and put it out there, and we started hitting conventions, and then I met James and Eric with Broken Icon Comics, and here I am.
Cool. So the, you know, I guess that's what people should take from that is, you know, always pursue what your first love is, you know, I think... Yeah, it's a lot of work, but if you love it, you know, you enjoy doing it at the same time. Or is that not
absolutely true? I totally enjoy it. I wish I would have pursued this dream when I was younger. I'm married and have two kids now, mm-hmm. and I have a whole new set of responsibilities. And the comic work, I start that usually after the kids go to bed, and I work long, long nights and get up and go to work, do my day job, and take care of the kids, and do it all over again. It is a commitment, and I wouldn't do it if I didn't love it so much.
Right. So you had mentioned Todd McFarlane, who's one of my favorite artists, and one of the things that I hear a lot about him when people talk about him is he does a lot of detail in all of his pieces. You know, like he was one of the. Like, he came up with the idea that the webbing was three threads coming out that were wrapped together, you know. And then artists after him hated him because, oh, he put in all this extra detail. Now I have to copy that. And so, you know, what about that? What about his style, I guess, attracted you? And do you feel, like you said, you don't copy people, but do you feel like you take anything from him when you do your work now?
Well, my inspiration started with him. And I think it was the energetic poses, because it was about the time when he started doing the Spider-Man Torment run.
Right.
And he put so many details in his pages, and he had characters hyperextended, and they were breaking out of the panels, and it was just energetic. And I as a teenager, I tried to put that much detail in. But then I think as I matured and I started to become aware of many, many other artists, I would start to pick and choose what I liked from a particular artist. It's weird. I went from the super detailed Todd McFarlane stuff to Frank Miller, Sin City. So okay. there's a broad range right there. And then I started to admire some of the more fine art comic book artists like Kent Williams and Bill Sienkiewicz and John J. Muth. And I think as I got older, I would kind of put them all in a blender and see what it looks like.
Right.
And I think my style changes depending on what I'm working on. So I don't know. I still like to think that everything I do is all me. There might be a little bit of somebody here, a little bit there, but I think overall it's just kind of my own style.
Right. No, and yes, I think all artists, you know, when the expression I heard before, I think was it might have been Picasso, I don't remember, but all great artists steal, you know. But what he meant by that was you're influenced by what you've seen before, you know.
And
it's true, you can't get away from that. Yeah, and when I look through the book, you can definitely see influences, but it's definitely your own style. One of the things that struck me, and I thought of it as Frank Miller-esque, is it's a black and white book with only certain parts colored in, specifically the blood. You know, is that something you guys, you know, decided on early? That's how you want to do it? Like, how did that, the coloring come about, the ideas for that?
Honestly, I think that's something that Todd just kind of did. I don't remember discussing it.
No, I don't think I did. In fact, if you look through the digital one, look really carefully, you'll notice that it's not all black and white, aside from the red. If you look really, really carefully, you'll see, like, doors mm-hmm. are just very desaturated.
Yeah.
There's a little bit in there.
Right.
I didn't make it strong, and I didn't go complete grayscale.
Right. No, and you know, I think it works well with the story. But was that, I guess I was asking, was that a bit of a Frank Miller influence, or did you just want the certain things to stand out to the reader?
I was afraid that if the blood was desaturated too much, that it wouldn't be noticed, that it would just kind of fall in with all the shadows. I don't know, maybe it was a little bit of Frank Miller coming out. I don't know. I just thought, wow, that'd look pretty cool if I did this. I like the splatters, but I also don't want to reverse them out so that they're white on black.
Right.
Because then I think it's tricky to try and keep the clarity when you're doing a lot of blood splatters if it's white on black, because sometimes it just gets confusing.
Right.
The red's a nice, it's easy, there it is. Everybody knows.
Yeah.
Cool. So, okay. because that was a lot of the questions I had about the book.
Well, about
the book itself.
How about we talk about the next phase?
Yeah, I was going to say, so what's, you know, I've seen the preview issue. What's the, you know, when's it coming out? What are the next phases for this book?
Well, I mean, the one that you read was, I think, the 16-pager, is that right? Where it ends with him entering into the van, right?
Yes.
That was actually just the short story. We released it as a short story, and it was just going to be this kind of one-and-done type thing. It's going to be a lot of fun, and then we'll just move on with our lives. And we started getting reviews in for it, and the reviews were overly positive. And then we started going to conventions, and people that had been in nearby regional conventions that had picked it up were coming back to our table saying, you know, I read this, I really liked it, what's next? And I wanted to be like, nothing. Nothing's next. That's a story. Why don't you just enjoy it as a story? But so many people, Eric called me up and he was like, I'm getting a lot of people saying they want to see more. Can you produce more? So I asked, you know, Todd if he was down to continue with the art, and he said sure. And so we got the next issue or the next installment of the horror show is going to be coming out on May 31st at the Tri-State Comic Con in Huntington, West Virginia. And it's going to be very, very scary. And I say that in like a dorky kind of voice, but I mean, I don't want to call it like, you know, a rip roaring gore fest, but it's going to move really fast, and it's going to have a lot of, I don't know, frightening exchanges within its pages.
It has the same suspense level that the first has.
Cool.
Yeah, you have to continue to tie that in, I guess, in order to make it complete as a series. I did want it to move, you know, as I said, a lot faster than the first one, because the first one, there are a lot of twists, you know, and mm-hmm. you can tell with the cover, you know, with the zombie, with the cut marker, or what, I don't even know what that's called. I wanted it to be deceiving, you know, but now that we got the secret out, now that the deception is over with, the next one, it's not very deceiving. It's very, you know, true to what it looks like.
Okay.
Because before, it killed me. It killed me so much because I couldn't tell people, look at this awesome monster, you know, when I was showing them the book. I would try to hide it from them and just be like, there's something in the shadows, you know. it's a naked guy. which is a common, but now we don't have to hide the monster, you know. On the cover of the horror show, too, it's the monster, you know, in kind of half human, half monster form, but he's there. There's no more hiding it. I can be very blatant with who our main character is.
Cool. Yeah. So, you know, it's funny because one of the things I wanted to point out is that I'm not a huge fan of horror comics, but yet, when I read this, like I said, and again, when I first looked over it, oh, just another zombie book, then it's like, oh, wow, no, this is really good. So even as someone who's not a fan of horror books, I would recommend this to people to read. Like, you have to read it because it's just really well done, you know?
Yeah, it's kind of strange. I'm probably, as far as like writing goes, I love to write horror, but I don't write horror, if that makes any sense. It's not like, you know, a slasher flick. It's got characterization. It's got thought. It's got philosophy in it. There's a lot of hard decisions being made, especially in this particular book. Mm-hmm. You know, because the main character, the guy, he doesn't want to hurt these people. He never wanted to hurt these people. He was happy living a regular life, and they had to go and screw with him, and you know, that's what you get. When you mess with people, you get a claw in your gullet. but it's really strange. I got somebody today that was like, I don't read. I mean, it's the same situation like you're saying. I don't read horror comics, and this is billed as a horror comic. But it's more drama mixed with horror.
Right.
So which requires a very good artist. You know, I mean, anybody can, well, not anybody, obviously. I can't draw for anything. but a lot of people can draw a zombie tearing up, you know, a crowd of people. They can't get on the nuances of the emotions that character is going through in a specific moment, you know?
Right.
The my favorite exchange is, and I'm kind of ruining it, but when the woman realizes what her fate is in the van, her face, that was like the whole book rested on if that panel came across and Todd got it across, and it was perfect.
Yes. Yeah, no. And I definitely agree with that. With the concept of in a book like this, yes, anyone, like you said, anyone can draw the horror side of it, the guts on the ground. It's the reactions of the regular people, you know, that's what sells something like this.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's what makes something. I mean, when I read a comic, there are those books that I read and it's like a running gun and, you know, it feels like it's over in 20 seconds, you know, and I'll never pick up that comic again. Mm-hmm. But if I sit down and, you know, read something that has things happening in the background, and I feel the emotion in the panels and the mood, and that's come together with the story. I'll go back and look for hidden details in that book. I mean, how many times has The Watchmen been read by anybody, or Sandman for that matter?
Right.
You know, because it's got more to it. The comics that have depth and that have layers are, that's what I like. That's what I like to read. That's what I like to write.
So Todd, you had said, or James had said that you, you know, right away said that you wanted to draw this. What was it that drew you to wanting to do this?
Well, I didn't realize actually pitching it to me when we were at the pub.
But yeah, we were just around talking.
And, yeah, and he's like, I got this idea. And he starts to tell me, and I was hanging on every word. And I remember I was laughing throughout it because I thought, oh, this is like a Tales from the Crypt, mm-hmm. which I love Tales from the Crypt and Twilight Zone. And I think this book really fits into that mold. But I thought, wow, that's really clever. And he's taking all these cliches and just kind of flipping them around. And then when we left the pub, he asked, so you in? I was, sure, yeah, absolutely. Because it was such a great, great story that he told me. And I was visualizing it as he was telling me. And I would have been an idiot to pass it up. And that's why I'm doing issue two and however many I told him. However many issues it takes to tell the story you want to tell, I'm with you. I'm with you till the end.
Ah, a match made in heaven. So, you also had said earlier that, you know, you now are married and have two kids. And, you know, anyone can argue James has the easy part of it, coming up with the story. And then you have the part of drawing it. How do you find time to, you know, pursue this passion and, you know, raise a family?
Well, that's why it's taken this long for issue two to come out.
Okay.
It's, like I said, I sit at my desk, usually around 9 o'clock, and I work on it until 2 a.m. And then I go to bed and make sure I have a full cup of coffee in the morning when I go to work. And, I want to do it enough. And hopefully it'll be short term that, in the sense, not that I won't have my wife and kids anymore, but short term in the sense that this will be my job. I can quit the day job. So I sacrifice now and hopefully it'll pay off down the road.
Right. I think it will. You know, it's a well-written story. The art is done really well. And I think people would be foolish not to go and check this book out. You know, it's definitely worth a read. So I wish you all the best of luck in making your day job.
Thank you.
So, I mean, I'm familiar with some of James' other work. Have you done any other books?
For me?
Yeah.
I did. Oh man, I've been doing books since '92. I self-published back in high school.
Oh, okay.
Some friends and I, inspired by Image, we thought, hey, yeah, we can do this. We're good. And we put together these really, really bad books. Well, my story was bad. They're anthologies, and we would go to Kinko's in the middle of the night because we had after, I think, 11 p.m., all photocopies were half off.
Okay.
So we would photocopy them, and Kinko's would let us use their stapler. They wouldn't charge us for service. They'd charge us staples. And we put it together, and we took it around town and sold them in some of the shops, and we set up at cons. And so that was my first exposure. But then it really didn't get serious about it until I did the webcomic, and we put together two printed books from the material that we made in the webcomic.
Hmm.
And it was a kind of a secretive superhero book. It's a superhero book that people weren't really aware that it was a superhero book.
Oh, okay.
More of an anti-hero. It was the book was called Yuri Gypsy Hunter, and it was about somebody who has the ability to blend into any situation. And we basically took the idea of Spider-Man, and instead of making a mistake, learning from it, and becoming a hero, this guy likes having this power, and he exploits it. He wants to see what he can get away with.
Okay.
And, we were working with that for about 2.5 issues, and then James told me about Horror Show, and we put Yuri on hold.
Oh, okay. So it's Spider-Man, without great power comes great responsibility.
Our tagline was, with great power comes no responsibility.
Okay. Cool.
So, and what's the other book you got coming up?
Oh, the other book with Chris Charlton of Assailant Comics?
Yeah.
That's called The Weight of Air, and it's based off of a premise. I can't write, but I come up with premises all the time, and it's kind of a secretive story. It's about a murder mystery with a psychic, and I approached Chris, told him my premise, asked if he'd be interested in writing it, and he wrote this fantastic 4-issue story, and I'll be working on that sometime soon.
Cool.
In addition to Horror Show, so I'll be doing 2 books simultaneously.
So
it'll be interesting, but I said 2014 is going to be my year of productivity.
And no sleep.
And no sleep.
And no sleep.
So, and then when the books are coming, when the book comes out, is it going to be available through Comixology and all those wonderful sites?
Yeah, we've been talking about how we're going to do a digital release. So we haven't kind of settled. All the print and PDFs will be available at brokenarcanacomics.com. And then eventually it's going to make its way onto Comixology.
Cool. So, yeah. And then, as you were talking about, when we started, maybe we can go back to that a little bit. So Amazon bought Comixology, huh?
Yeah. Looks to be the size of it.
Oh.
Again, I don't know if that's good or bad. Today. Yeah, this was a recent thing. And by recent, I mean a couple hours ago.
Right. And, yeah, I mean, there's no information about how much either.
Yeah, guess I kind of keep trying to keep that hush hush. The cool thing is that Amazon's going to have a wider spread, and what they've been doing with, you know, stuff like Kickstarter, they've kind of let, from what I understand, they've kind of let them go and do that business the way that they want. They're just a subsidiary.
Okay.
I'm thinking that this is going to be the same deal where is going to continue to do what they can. They just might have a little bit more financial muscle to try off the wall things. So that could be good.
Hopefully.
I mean, the one thing I will say about Amazon, they're innovative. You know, they don't, you see new stuff coming from them almost every quarter, it seems.
Right.
So, I'm optimistic. Because, I mean, I have, right now, I mean, we just put the debt up on Comixology, and that's helped our visibility a lot. I'm looking forward to putting new stuff. I actually just submitted Clown to see what they think of it.
Is it a long process to get stuff approved on Comixology, or
sometimes? Yeah. From my experience, I think we had to wait like over a month to get approval for The Dead, and then they had like a special release date that they wanted to put it up, and then for the second issue of that one, I think that was another 2-month process, or 2-month release maybe is a better phrase.
Mm-hmm. Right. I guess if you're Marvel or DC, they...
Yeah, they have to expedite, I'm sure. But the good thing is that they're jurying in stuff, it seems. You know, like I've had a few people say that, you know, their stuff didn't make it on there. And whether or not that stuff was good or controversial or whatever, it seems that there is some kind of selection process.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I guess that's good, right? You don't want to throw anything out there, you know.
Sure.
Like with podcasts, we can just put anything online and people listen. So, yeah.
I don't know. I mean, there's obviously ways to get things across, but to issue a threshold, I don't know. I think it makes people do just a little bit more to try to reach that threshold.
Right. So, so I joked around when we started about you and your, when you're going to do a bunny story. But have you ever played with the idea of doing, you know, a superhero or something a little more traditional?
Me?
Yes.
Actually, Rob Dumo, who I worked with on Nightmare Unknown, he came to me with an idea of a superhero story that he had been wanting to write but had never gotten, you know, the... But for himself, I think maybe he didn't, you know, it was the same thing. He wasn't confident with the storytelling, but he came up with some interesting characters. And it's all, I mean, Rob is a superhero artist, you know, that's what he needs to be doing because he does it so well. So he brought me this really kind of funny, dark, well, he brought me a funny story and I turned it dark. So it's going to be the mix of, you know, serious superhero and a little bit of comedy thrown in.
Okay, we'll let that slide then.
Yeah, like I said, I'm hoping that we're going to get to it within the end of this year. I hope it's done by the end of this year, so we can start showing it around.
Cool. And Todd, how about you? Like, what would be an end game for you? Would you just want to keep on doing working with Broken Icon, or would you be happy if, let's say, Jim Lee from DC saw your work and said, hey, why don't you come work for us?
Well, I love working with Broken Icon, but I like working with a lot of different people.
Mm-hmm.
I like being kind of a free agent and just being able to jump around and do things with many different creators. I think my ultimate plan would be, my dream would be to get picked up by a big publisher and dabble in that for a little bit. But I think ultimately I would probably go back to creator owned. I like really being able to control what's going on in my art. I like to be able to not have to answer to a board of directors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I also would like to try and bring some of my fine art into the comics. I do this kind of a stained glass style of painting. I would love to be able to do variant covers for a major publisher,
mm-hmm.
using this style. I just like to be able to do whatever I want to do. I think everybody likes it, it feels the same way, but I like the freedom in creator-owned comics,
right?
That I don't think people usually get with the major publishers.
Yeah, no, I definitely could see that. I think that's why, you know, people like Steve Scott are doing, you know, is doing like Blue Nemesis, you know, because he has the freedom, you know, to do the book the way he wants to do it, you know, and I totally get that. I mean, some of the artists I know who work for the big two, you know, a lot of them are freelance, you know, like they don't want to work, and they like that. They don't want to work for Marvel or DC. They want the freedom to be able to go back and forth. And, you know, someone like, a friend of mine, Greg Horn, I've asked him a couple times, like, you know, why do you just do covers, or why do you mostly just do covers? You know, and of course he made the comment like you did earlier about interiors. It's a lot of work, you know. But then he was like, well, because I have the freedom of, they want an iconic picture of Wonder Woman. I can draw an iconic picture of Wonder Woman for DC, and then I'm done with them. I'm not working them for them for months.
Yeah.
You know, it's a one and done kind of thing, and then you can move on. And Marvel wants him to do a cover for Wolverine number one, which he just did. You know, he does the cover for them, he promotes it a little bit, and he's done. You know, move on. You know,
I sat down with Daniel Way not too long ago and had a phone kind of conversation / interview with him, and he was talking about, you know, he did Deadpool and he did Wolverine, and he was like, I'm focusing on my stuff now. You know, I think that it comes down to the point where you can only write somebody else's character for so long.
Right.
And there are some writers out there, and they're awesome, you know, that take the character that they're given, or they choose the character that they think that they can kind of revolutionize, and they could go on to write that, you know, forever. The one that immediately comes to mind is Matt Fraction dealing with Hawkeye. I haven't read a lot of Hawkeye, but when I picked that up, I knew that was his, you know, like that was his take, his style mixed with the character, and he made it kind of his. So if you can do that, if you're fortunate enough and you're talented enough to make that happen, then go for it, you know, write Hawkeye and collect a decent paycheck, and that's great. but I have no doubt that he's going to continue to do all of the creator own stuff that we've seen come out of him too.
Right. Yeah. I mean, they say that, right? That any writer who picks up a character, they though do say that, like, oh, this is my take on it, and everything that previous guy did, that didn't really count.
Yeah. You know? Well, I think more to the point of that is, if I wanted to write, you know, a Geoff Johns story, then I might as well just quit doing what I'm doing.
Right.
Because if you want to read a Geoff Johns story, then there are a ton of them.
Right. Exactly.
You don't need me to emulate it.
True. And even on the side of art, when John Romita Sr. took over The Amazing Spider-Man, he actually copied Steve Ditko's style for the first few issues that he did, because at the time they were afraid, you know, people would stop reading the book if it was a different artist on the mm-hmm. book. And he didn't even really get, I remember something about he didn't even get credit at the beginning. And, you know, that's all well and good, but, you know, if they wanted Steve Ditko on the book, then they should have just kept Steve Ditko. Like, the artist should get the ability to express the character the way they want to.
Sure. It seems like a lot of the publishers do that with transitional states. They, as one artist leaves, they bring in another artist who's similar, and then you start to see a morphing into their regular style. It happens so much.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, if an artist cuts out and they need someone to fill in, or if, you know, the that's big business, you know, like that it's very jarring to read an issue of a story and then the next issue that continues your storyline that you've been kind of like sucked into. It might make it a little bit jarring to go back into it. I do see like the purpose of it for that kind of situation, but if you're starting your own wing, if you're or your own run on a particular storyline, yeah, totally make it your own.
Yeah, I think that's Todd, you can agree or disagree with me, but I think that's one of the reasons a lot of people like Todd McFarlane was his art was so different from everything else that was in all the other books. Mm-hmm. You know, like, yes, there was, he still was drawing Spider-Man that looked like Spider-Man, but, you know, there was a bit of an anime style, a bit of a Saturday morning cartoon feel in some of the stuff, and it's just, you know, it struck you because it was different, and, like, a lot of people gravitated to it because of that, you know, and, but like you said, if you're in the middle of a story and all of a sudden the art changes, that's difficult, you know.
Well, specifically talking about Todd McFarlane, if you remember when he left Hulk, Eric Larson jumped on, mm-hmm. and it was a very similar style. And then McFarlane left Amazing Spider-Man, and Larson took over, and it was very similar. And then the Spider-Man book, when he left, Larson came on, and it was almost like he's the transitional artist for McFarlane at that point. Yeah. Now he's Eric Larson. He's only Eric Larson. But then I think of other books, like I can't remember specifically what the issue number is, but there was an X-Force. Early on X-Force, when Rob Liefeld was drawing it,
mm-hmm.
I remember picking up a book, and I will admit, I was a Liefeld fan back during the New Mutants X-Force days, and people roll their eyes when I say that, but I was, and I remember picking up a book, I opened it up, and it's like, what is going on? This is weird art. It was Mike Mignola, and mm-hmm. Liefeld did the cover and the first page, but then the rest, it took place in a different timeline, and it was all Mike Mignola, and I remember being shocked when I saw that. Not in a good way,
right?
Because that's not where I was in my tastes. Since then, I've grown to love Mignola, and but it was a shock to the system because I wasn't expecting it.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the other extreme when you have somebody who comes in with a totally different vision, and it doesn't really fit with the previous artist.
Right.
I look at that now, and it's like, well, forget the Rob Liefeld pages. I want to look at the Mignola.
So, if somebody asked you to fill in for, I'm trying to think of somebody who's oh, my mind just went blank. Artist on the Batman books right now, with Scott, with Snyder.
Hmm? Greg Capullo?
Yeah, Capullo. So they said, we want you to be the transitional artist for Capullo, so copy his style, you know. Is that something you would want to do, or would it be like, no, if I can't do my own style, I don't want to do it?
I don't know, drawing Batman, that'd be a pretty hefty paycheck. It would be hard, though, because you would have to curb all of your instincts to draw the way you normally draw. And I haven't actively tried to mimic anybody since I was a teenager. So I don't know. I would probably say I'll give it a shot.
Okay, that's fair.
Yeah, I would look forward to the challenge of doing something like that.
Right. I don't know. I mean, it would be, you know, I can't draw, so I guess it would never come up. But it would be difficult for me because it'd be like, wow, I'm getting to draw Batman, but I can't put my stamp on him. You know, I have to copy the guy before me. I don't know. It'd be difficult to say yes to it.
I don't know. Would Glapion be inking me? Because if Glapion inks me, I'll draw any book they want.
No, James is inking you.
Yeah,
I haven't seen his work.
Oh, okay.
Although I keep teasing him about whenever we sell books at cons, I always do a little zombie head. I always tell him, draw something, I'll ink it.
Yeah, I'll do that and take a picture and send it to you.
All right, that's good. Scan it, I'll blue line it, I'll ink it, I'll send it back to you.
All right, cool.
Hey, we're making an auction item for Tricon.
There you go.
There you go. And you heard it here first. So,
hey.
So if that auction item isn't available, don't blame me.
All right.
I'm shocked that somebody that that you know loves comics and writes comics hasn't attempted to draw.
Oh, I never said that.
Oh, okay.
I just didn't like what came out of my pencil, so.
All right, so that's fair. I'll give you that. So, all right.
I've written a lot of... well, I can't even say that with a straight face, sorry. I was going to say, I've written a lot of poetry. Nobody's seen that. I've never written poetry, really.
No. I wrote a lot of poetry in high school.
Yeah.
No one's ever seen it. And no one ever will.
It's locked in a safe.
Yes.
Underwater.
It's in a footlocker in the basement.
There you go.
So, all right. I guess, we're getting near the end. So, I guess, where can people find you online, Todd?
Everywhere. I have a Todd Beistel Art Facebook page. I have a Todd Beistel Artist Facebook page. I have a website. It's beisteldesign.com, BEISTEL design.com. And just a couple weeks ago, I opened up a Store Envy page where I sell my art, and that address is toddbeistel.storeenvy.com. And I've got Twitter, and I'm on other places also. I can't remember where. I'm everywhere.
Are you fairly active online?
I am. I'm on Facebook specifically. Twitter, I try to be on Twitter. But I forget many times.
You know, you can probably link your Twitter and your Facebook so that, you know,
you're up to the same. I
was doing that for a while, but I felt like I was bombarding people.
Yeah, that's actually the reason I broke up my Twitter-Facebook link. Like, I do Facebook posts when it's, you know, usually when it's just about work. My personal page is really just a work page in disguise. But my Twitter account is just like whatever is in my head, 2 seconds, that's all I need is to jot it down and throw it away and forget that it ever happened. I think that's what Twitter's mainly about. It's just a bunch of people yelling at the top of their lungs. Every once in a while somebody hears a yell next to them that they repeat for a while. It's all chaos. But yeah, I didn't want my Facebook page to be that, you know. I wanted it to have structure.
Cool.
So I feel you.
Actually, I'm on your art Facebook page now, and did you do these Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, or?
Yeah, I did. Cool. I did those for Gem City.
Oh, okay, cool. Teamwork, adventure, creativity, ambition, and intelligence.
Yeah, I just started doing these motivational posters. Guy I work with, his department was moved to another part of the building, and they had these motivational posters, you know, the standard motivational posters of a mountain, and it says, like, expectation or something. And we were talking about those, and I said, he wanted to put his comic book poster up. I said, just put it on a motivational poster. And then I thought, well, that would be pretty cool. A comic book character on a motivational poster. I've seen memes like that, but I've never seen prints at a convention that you can buy. You know, buy it, a physical one, hang it up in your office. So I started doing this a couple of weeks ago, and they've become pretty successful. People like them.
Yeah, they look fun. I might, if I see you at a show, I might buy one.
I'll have them.
Okay. And I'm sorry, I don't mean to derail this conversation, but I just noticed you have a Hydra Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Thing on your page here. And are you watching?
Yes, I am. That's a really cool design that a friend of mine, Jeff Carlisle, designed.
Oh, okay.
And he posted it on Facebook today, and I thought, well, that's really cool, so I shared it.
Yeah.
I am watching it. I liked it from the beginning. I think I'm one of the few that really liked it.
Mm-hmm.
I know they're trying to build it up. They couldn't jump into intense, intricate stories in the beginning because they had to establish the characters
right.
first. But I think it's starting to grab hold of what the show is supposed to be.
Yeah, it's we actually, along with Superhero Speak, we do another podcast. It's a YouTube show called Agents of Speak, which we do live right after each episode. And the biggest criticisms I got in the beginning was that because people were expecting a superhero show, and it's like, no, it's based on S.H.I.E.L.D. It's a spy show, which I thought they did very well in the beginning. And then they did a lot of character building, and then, oh, wow, I just can't believe they went there with Ward.
Oh, this week's episode was incredible.
Oh, my goodness.
The twists and turns.
Yes, and it's, and we're probably losing James, but, but the thing, like, I realized afterwards, it's like, you didn't need to see Captain America before you watched that episode, but it ruined Captain America because all the major plot points were revealed in that episode. So, yeah.
I missed Cap too. I haven't seen that yet.
Oh, but you saw last week's episode or this week's episode.
I did. And I saw yesterday that the viewership was really down. It dropped like 15% from the previous week.
Oh,
and I'm thinking the only reason for this, people DVR'd it and they're waiting until after to see Captain America 2.
Yeah. That's probably what it was. Because I saw Captain America on Sunday, and it was, I was just shocked by how much it tied in. Not how much it tied in, but how much was revealed in the episode. It's like, wow, you know. So, yeah, that's probably, you're probably right. People are waiting to watch it until they see the movie.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but it's definitely getting very Whedon-esque. I really hope they have a season 2, because I'm loving it. Yes, I'm sorry, I derailed the conversation, but I love the show. So on that note, all right, and James, you have anything else that you want to plug?
I have a Kickstarter going on for The Dead right now. We met our goal in 6 days, which was awesome.
Cool.
So now we're just kind of trying to hit our stretch goal marks. We've got a lot of great backers helping us out.
Cool. Cocoa butter can help with the stretch marks. But cool. And I'm going to plug one thing real quick. Everyone who's listening, if you haven't done so yet, please head on over to our Tug event. Our link is on our Facebook and our page, and it'll be on. We'll put in the description of this episode, and buy tickets to see Legends of the Night playing here in the Philly area on April 27th. 10% of the proceeds are going to the National MS Society, and we're also taking donations for the National MS Society through the Tug website. So if you haven't done so yet, please go and check it out, and we really appreciate your support. So on that note, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening. Don't let your capes get caught in the door. Have a good week. Speaking of capes, you can tug on ours by joining the conversation on Facebook, Twitter, or Google+ at Superhero Speak. If you have any comments on my bad jokes, you can email me at dave@superheroespeak.com.
You can also subscribe to our podcast through iTunes, Stitcher, and various other channels. Or if you'd like to tease the beard of knowledge, you can email me at ben@superheroespeak.com.
We also occasionally rant about things on our website, superheroespeak.com. Or, if you'd like to further discuss the prowess of Rainbow Dash versus anybody in the greater geek universe, you can email me at john@superheroespeak.com.
And don't forget to check out our Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. companion show, Agents of Speak, which you can watch live most Tuesdays around 9 p.m. on our Google Plus page, or archived on our YouTube channel. Now let go of our cape. This episode of Superhero Speak was brought to you by Blueberry.com. Head on over to Blueberry.com and use the offer code SUPERHEROSPEAK to get 1 month free on their hosting or premium statistic plans. That's Blueberry.com, BLUBRRY.com.